You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including important infrastructure on the Oregon coast that is at risk of failing, how utility companies are preparing for wildfire season, and why a lack of housing can make it difficult for homeless people to recover after surgery or illness. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm Roman Battaglia, politics, science, and environment reporter.
Reporter Jane Vaughn is off today, but we'll start with this conversation we recorded with her yesterday about her latest story. Jane, you wrote a story this week about medical respite care. First, can you explain what that is?
Yes, it was a new concept to me too, but it's basically a type of medical care for homeless people who are sort of in an in-between there. They're not quite sick enough for the hospital, but they're not healthy enough to take care of themselves on their own. And so medical respite care basically provides some medical care, and it's a quiet, clean place where people can rest and heal from whatever it is. For example, I talked to someone who had to get radiation therapy for cancer, and so they needed a place to rest. It could be a wound. It could be an infection. I heard a story of someone who needed to start a medication for their diabetes and needed a place to rest near a bathroom because there were some GI symptoms. So something like that that could potentially put someone in a hospital, something that could be hard to heal on a street, hard to keep a wound clean, things like that. So it can both sort of prevent hospitalizations and also be sort of a safe discharge plan from the hospital after homeless people are leaving. And the sort of concern is that if you don't have this sort of care, it can lead to worse outcomes or more hospitalizations or worse health in general. And it's interesting because these are people, like I said, who are homeless, and they might be someone in general who could need a home health aide, but they don't have a home for a health aide to visit. Maybe they would qualify to be in some sort of facility, like a skilled nursing facility, but they might not have insurance. The insurance might not cover long stays there. So medical respite is sort of trying to fill in this gap for those medical needs.
So did these programs, these medical respite programs, seem to be working?
In some places, yeah. I guess I said it's sort of a new idea to me personally, but there's one in Redding that I talked to extensively. I know there's one that just opened up in Spokane this year in January. There's one in Medford. So they are up and running. They're around. I looked at the HOPE program in Redding, which stands for Health Outreach for People Everywhere. That's part of the Shasta Community Health Center. And they have medical respite that involves going into hotels. They'll house people in hotel rooms. They also have a house called the Hartman House, which is sort of a mixture of a community center and a home and a doctor's office. They have room for 15 people. And so there's a medical clinic. They get the medical care. And then people staying there can also get case management and whatever, you know, sort of social services they need. People usually stay for a few months. And then the goal is obviously they get discharged to a more permanent, longer term housing situation. And they said that they helped 133 people last year. So that program does seem to have some success.
Wow, that's quite a few. So it sounds like there's a need for more medical respite care. Is that happening?
Sort of. So both Oregon and California seem to have made it somewhat of a goal, or at least a recommendation, to increase medical respite. Oregon recently had a specific task force on hospital discharge challenges, which is sort of related. So the goal of that task force was trying to prevent people from staying in the hospital too long and just sort of languishing there. And so, like I said, I talked to Dr. Kyle Patton, who's the medical director of the HOPE program at the Shasta Community Health Center. He also provides medical care to homeless people on the streets. And he was saying that that can happen, that people end up staying in the hospital for a long time, longer than they really need to, because they just don't have somewhere safe to be discharged too. So here's what he had to say about that.
Where do you send them? You may not have a medical respite in your community. You may not have enough like skilled nursing space. And then your patient doesn't have like a supportive home environment or living environment. And so like you're not supposed to discharge them to the streets or the shelter. And then what do? They stay in a hospital bed for a period of time.
And so one of the recommendations that this Oregon task force had about hospital discharge challenges is they actually recommended increasing medical respite statewide, because that would help with the hospital discharge challenge piece. That report came out in December from the task force. There's now a bill in the Oregon legislature at the moment that would direct the Department of Human Services and the Health Authority to study options to expand medical respite. So the bill hasn't passed yet, but it's, you know, in the legislature, they're working on it. And there was a similar recommendation made in California, actually, in 2023 that recommended increasing the availability of medical respite. So again, it's sort of in the works and somewhat. It does seem to be that sometimes there's a little bit of a gap between certain state agencies and different entities and stakeholders. I talked to one source who was talking about our system is not structured for the overlap between mm-hmm. housing and healthcare. They're sort of different entities, but there's a lot of overlap between housing and healthcare. I also talked to Dr. Patton, who said that funding can sometimes be tricky for medical respite, and so that's not necessarily encouraging more medical respite centers to open. So there's some movement, but also it would take some time to open up new programs. And then, of course, there's still the bigger question, the bigger problem of what happens after you leave medical respite. Homeless people still need to find longer-term housing, and so that's still a problem.
Well, thanks for your reporting, Jane, and enjoy your day off.
Thank you.
Well, that was Jane Vaughn. And Justin, you had a story for us out of Coos County on tide gates. First, tell us, what is a tide gate and what's up with them?
Yeah, so this was a cool story for me because I really had no idea this very vital piece of infrastructure even existed. So that was cool to learn about. So tide gates keep tidal flows from flooding land near the coast, basically. They look like kind of one-way doors. They're built on waterways like a river or outlet that feeds into the ocean. And it's really an ingenious and kind of deceptively simple idea. So when there's a high tide, the door is pushed closed. And then when there's low tide, that door opens. It swings open, letting the fresh water in the outlet drain into the ocean. Having these tide gates allows ranchers and farmers to make use of a lot of coastal land that would otherwise be inundated with salt water. And as everyone knows, salt water isn't good for crops. It also protects infrastructure from flooding, like roads and in more urban areas, even buildings. And I learned that many of these tide gates are actually failing or on the verge of failing, which means those doors won't work properly when they do fail. And that puts land and a lot of important infrastructure at risk.
Well, why are these tide gates in trouble?
They're getting old. So many were put in during the 1950s. Some are made of wood. And so they're just really at the end of their lifespan. And they need to be replaced. But that's been harder than you might expect. So there's more than 1,000 tide gates in Oregon. And Coos County has the most out of every county. About a third of all tide gates in the state are in Coos County. So I went over to North Bend in Coos County and spoke with a rancher about what's standing in the way of replacing these structures. And a major hurdle that I learned is regulations. So to be able to repair or replace one of these tide gates can involve something like 10 different agencies getting permission from all those different bodies. One reason for that burdensome regulatory process is the location of these tide gates. So they can be in sort of a confusing intersection of private, state, or county lands. There's also fairly recent regulations meant to help fish, like the endangered coho salmon, use these waterways. So the tide gates need to be built so they can stay open long enough for fish passage. Because if they fail, you're blocking salmon spawning routes.
So a lot of regulations, a lot of jurisdictions. Are there any other barriers?
Yeah, the cost, which is somewhat related to the regulations, they can just cost a lot more now than they used to, kind of like everything. I visited a new tide gate they put in last year on Palouse Creek near North Bend, and that cost around $3 million to build. And they were actually trying to figure out a way to replace that for decades, like going through the planning and permitting process. So that's a pretty big tide gate, and it has all the sort of, you know, latest tide gate technology, like something called a muted tidal regulator, which makes sure the gates stay open long enough. It's side hinged rather than top hinged, which is very important for some reason. But this tide gate is owned by the drainage district, and others can be owned by private property owners. And it's just a heavy price tag for ranchers to try to replace these on their own. Also, just getting through the permitting process is expensive. This rancher told me that for some of these smaller tide gates, the process is more expensive than actually building the thing.
Well, are there any solutions for replacing these tide gates faster, getting through those regulations and paying for them?
Yeah, so in 2017, the state created the Oregon Tide Gate Partnership to study some of these barriers to repairing and replacing tide gates. And that group did help streamline some of the regulatory process. So, you know, as burdensome as the permitting process is now, it used to be way worse. And this rancher actually brought up an interesting point to me. You know, there's regulations around coho, salmon, and fish passage, which makes building these things harder. But that also opens up the possibility for conservation grants. And that's how this tide gate at Palouse Creek was funded. So there's opportunities there. The Oregon Tide Gate Partnership also tries to coordinate some of these grants, but replacing them is still really hard right now, and it's not something that those in Coos County can, you know, wait decades for. You know, like I mentioned, some really vital infrastructure would be at risk from flooding if these tide gates failed. So, you know, it's not only about farmers and ranchers making use of the cropland, but it's, you know, they protect roads and emergency services, and just daily life would really be impacted if they were to fail.
Well, thanks for covering that, Justin. Roman, you give us an update on how the region's largest power company is preparing for wildfire season. What did we hear from them?
Yeah, so the largest power company is Pacific Power, which covers most of Southern Oregon and Northern California. They also cover different parts of Oregon, including part of Portland. But they've been holding public forums over the past month or so to discuss the wildfire safety methods that they use. And according to their meteorologist, they're expecting a hot and dry summer this year, which could mean more wildfire. Mm. And the danger is even more higher when you go east of the Cascade, so like in Klamath Falls. So I talked to a person at Pacific Power about how they're working to prevent wildfires. They have it sounds like there are a lot of what are called grid hardening projects in the area, including around Mount Shasta, Grants Pass, and Cave Junction. And these are all like projects that they're doing to help strengthen the grid to make it less likely to break in the event of major weather, but also less likely to cause a wildfire itself. So they're doing things like replacing, you know, those wooden poles that you see with metal ones. They're also making the power lines more insulated so that they're less likely to cause a spark. And then they're also using these special attachments that help, you know, ward off birds or branches from falling onto the power lines. So, you know, it's going to prevent them from setting a fire, but also hopefully mean less outages in general for people, especially in the summer. And this was also a time that they're kind of making sure people are aware of other things like enhanced safety settings for, you know, the grid.
Well, last summer, as you know firsthand, mm-hmm. residents and talent faced a large number of power outages because of those enhanced safety settings. Could you explain what that means and how talent might be affected this year?
Yeah, so enhanced safety settings are these, they're basically special settings. It's like a switch that Pacific Power can turn on, and it makes the power grid extra sensitive, essentially. So, you know, what happens often is what's called a fault, and that can be when like a bird lands on a power line or if a branch falls on a power line. That can, you know, create a fault in the system where the branch or something might, you know, get infused with power, I guess, and start heating up and could cause a fire. And so normally the branch will just fall off. And
maybe
not
your
cause a big issue. Yeah, your lights might flicker. That's why if you ever notice your power flickering, it's because a branch probably hit a power line somewhere. And normally the settings aren't sensitive enough that it doesn't cause a big of a deal because you're not as worried about wildfire. But in the summer, they turn that on. And that means instead of, you know, the power just turning right back on, it has to turn off completely, and then they have to have someone come out and inspect all the lines, make sure that a branch isn't on there that's going to cause a fire or something before they turn the power back on. And so talent seemed to be really unlucky last summer. They had reports of between 40 to 70 outages. I live in Talent, and there were a lot of outages that were, you know, they ranged from, you know, an hour to sometimes I think one was 10 hours or something.
Wow.
And so it really affected a lot of people, especially businesses in the region. And Talent seemed to be the only one in the Rogue Valley affected. I know there were other places that did also get a lot of outages, but, you know, Talent just seemed to be unlucky with a lot of birds hitting the lines, a lot of branches, and a lot of other stuff. And, you know, even the president of Pacific Power had to come down here to talk to a bunch of angry residents about this. And since then, they made a lot of changes that'll hopefully fix the problem.
Well, what are those changes that they made?
Yeah, so they did a lot of things to prevent contact with power lines, like trimming the vegetation, installing what's called bird diverters, and they also split up the grid into more parts to make it less likely that an outage is going to affect you. It'll affect a smaller region, and also install these detectors that help determine where a fault could occur to kind of fix these and solve it quicker.
Well, and quickly, what should people know to be prepared for wildfire season this year, at least as far as utilities go?
Yeah, I mean, be prepared for an outage. I mean, all year really, but especially during wildfire season, and, you know, have an emergency kit ready. You can go, ready.gov has a really good list of things that you can do to prepare for an emergency, including wildfires and power outages.
Thanks, Roman. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform.